Welcome to Overcrest. I'm Chris.
And I'm Jake.
And look, I'm in a new spot.
Oh, you're in a new spot.
Yeah.
Are you actually in a new spot or did you just change your camera angle?
Everything's different. I had to get my workbench back, which you can't see it because it's in the dark over there.
Right.
But I had my vice literally right next to all this stuff.
Right.
The vice was...
Yeah, and you would constantly fidget with it. You were fidgeting with your vice constantly.
Fidgeting with the vice, yeah, constantly on all those Zoom meetings.
Everything. Bad news.
Anyway, but I was working, pounding on this vice and, the computer's right there. And
right there, yeah.
This is not good. Plus, I didn't have, a workbench space or anything like that.
Yeah,
however,
that's bad.
I'm going to do one thing quick. It's going to drive me nuts if I have to sit
What's
here
that?
And deal with it the whole thing. You just, you narrate what I'm doing while I'll be right back.
Okay. So, yeah, you're still in the garage. And he's running over. Oh, there was a photo hanging in the background that was not quite straight. Which, that would have bugged me too. That would have bugged
awful.
Me too.
Yeah. Especially if you would have noticed it.
All right. So for those following along and watching you, what is the sign there?
This one on the door?
Yeah, it looks like a street sign that's faded or something.
Yeah, it's all beat up. I found this when I was scouting the Idaho rally.
Oh, cool.
It was laying in the road. Someone had run over it, and it was laying in the middle of the road. It was on some twisty, curvy road. So I picked it up and threw it in the back of the wagon. It slid right in. Slid right in. It was like,
meant to be.
Shunk. Yeah, it was,
meant
just,
to be.
It was just meant to be. Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Okay. The first time I've gotten to hang it up. So
I like this. This is a better backdrop for you. I like
it. Yeah. I'm looking at better stuff too. I've got your pretty face, but then I've got all this, there's penthouses over here, Playboy, steering wheel, Andrew Ritter stuff, not to put him
good
in.
Good for morale.
Yeah, everything's good for morale right now.
So on the same level as penthouse, is that what you're going to say with Andrew
Ritter? Yeah, I mean, it's car porn.
Yeah,
you can
there
go
you
with
go.
That, right? Yeah.
I like it. I do have to, you're doing the number one sin, though, that you always yell at me for, is you're
wearing
black.
Yeah, but I know how to
you
control
disappear.
My exposure. Yeah, my face is actually here.
Yeah, okay. But
I'll take it off. I was putting a hoodie on because it's 62 degrees.
It feels like fall all of a sudden here in Minnesota, which as a kid, I always hated fall. And I realized why that is. It was basically ingrained in us because that's when school started. Summer mm-hmm. break was over, right? So you hated it because it was back to school, back to basically what work was as a kid. And so that's why you always associate fall with being negative and winter comes and all the summer activities are over. It's done. But as an adult, I realize I like fall weather the best, right? I'm sad that it means the end of summer and that winter's approaching. But if you just take fall as a season in itself, I love fall.
That's great. Yeah, that's why I'm moving.
It's exciting.
That's why I'm leaving. I want to go somewhere where there's more.
You keep saying that.
It's more like fall. Dude, I'm going to leave. Just you wait.
Okay.
I'm going to get out of here.
Yep.
At some
Let's
point.
See when that happens. At
I know,
some
I can't.
Point. Chris Lee,
like, I
65, finally able to retire, whatever that looks like for you, and that's when you move.
Yeah, well, whenever. It's going to happen, even if it's at 65. I can't deal with winters anymore, man.
It's
not good. What am I going
to
get for a winter beater this year? I don't have another car. I've been driving the 911 whenever I need to go somewhere. Mm. That's been my daily driver. So what do I do?
I know. I don't know. That used to be part of the fun process, right?
No, it's not.
A fun winter beater.
Nope. Don't care.
No.
Don't care. I've gotten to the point now where I need some level of, when you're younger, embarrassment isn't as big of a deal.
Yeah. Okay. I get that. And this is rare coming from you, right?
Yeah,
because that was the number one gripe of that escort that I had during our filming of
Yeah, but
the
you're
best
talking
of the
about
worst.
Embarrassment for other people. I'm talking about embarrassment to myself.
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm talking about.
Well, no. You were worried about what other people thought of you when you were
what
seen
you
in
how
that car.
Embarrassment is how you are projecting yourself to other people. Why else would you be embarrassed?
You can be embarrassed to yourself. Feel shame.
Okay. Self-shame.
Self-shame,
so you feel shameful of yourself because
I look at I'm driving some rusty shitbox. We have the Golf R. What I would like to do...
Better.
Is I'd like to buy a Maverick.
Yeah. Yep. The new Ford small truck.
I'd like to buy a Maverick, but every time I think about it, I'm like, well, I'll never get one because they're months away and
they are.
I don't have the attention span to put $500 down on something and then just wait a year.
I mean, you could and then get something in the meantime.
Like what?
I don't know. Whatever you want.
So I was talking to our buddy Colin and he mentioned a car that I really like.
Oh boy. Okay.
Honda Fit.
He like just a manual. Sent me one. Did he just send you one this morning? Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, we were talking about it the other day. I feel like a Honda Fit would be, if it's nice, the problem is all these cars are destroyed. Any old Honda is a mess. It's a mess. I don't understand. Why are there so many stains on everything? What is it with old Hondas and being like the seats are just destroyed? Like, what happened here?
Yeah, I don't know. I guess.
Is it Coke? Is it a bodily fluid? What is it?
All of
the
above.
Was there a murder?
Unfortunately, all of the above.
All at the same time. Yeah, yes, murder, bodily fluid, Coca-Cola.
Well, when the guy got murdered, you know, he spilt his Coke, right? Because he got murdered in there.
Yeah, I saw that in Forensic Files for sure. It matched the Coke from the McDonald's that he went through the drive-thru at. They sampled it, caught the killer.
Yes.
You know, I wonder, you know, they say Coke's pretty consistent at McDonald's. So I don't know if you could go into McDonald's and test the Coke and be like, hey, we tested the Coke in these seats. And the Coke at McDonald's 1061 over there in Forest Lake, Minnesota, it's a match. Guilty. Uh-huh. Murder.
Obviously,
I don't know if that's
going
to work.
Do you know that Coke from McDonald's is actually different than you'd get out
of
a bottle?
It's formulated differently, yeah.
It's more concentrated is basically all it is. Because they account
turn up the
for
juice
the ice
a little bit.
Melting. Right. So that's the whole point is they account for the ice melting to get to the proper ratio. So by the time you drink it, it is stronger. And that's why it tastes better.
Have a Coke right here. I'm trying not to drink as much soda because I was drinking very little
you
water.
You yelled at me for my bottle of water.
Well, it was in the shot. It was like, it was as big as your head.
It is a very large bottle of water. Yes.
Yeah. Problem is I don't like peeing. It's a waste of time. You're ever on a project and you're like, you're trying to do something
Enter
and you're
Chris
trying to
wearing Depends all of the time.
No, so you're working on your motor, you're doing whatever, and you're wrenching away. And like you're trying to, but you gotta pee at the same time.
It's always when you're trying to concentrate on something, right?
And
then
it like, stupid penis, what are you doing? You know, it's like you're just trying to get away. And then you have to throw the tools down, go pee, come back, and your train of thought's totally ruined. It's a waste of time.
And then your tools are gone somewhere.
I used to, in the summertime, I just open this door and I go pee outside. That's the fastest thing to do is just pee out there. There's a bunch of ferns. Yep. I pee all over the ferns. So
yeah,
I don't roll around my ferns.
It's great.
Yeah. I need a lemon tree, like in what's the movie with the guy who builds motorcycles. He always pees on his lemon tree with Anthony Hopkins.
Yeah, the world's fastest Indian.
Yeah. I got to see that movie again. Great movie.
Great movie.
I want to forge a piston, Jake.
Yeah, he did. He forged his own pistons, and then he had the shelf that was the altar to the speed gods, and it was all like the melted pistons.
Yeah. I think that might be where I got my little dude that I made. My altar to the speed gods
welded,
is like my little metal doll that I've got that's got all kinds of different parts welded to them. From all the broken shit.
Yeah. Speaking of, throwing tools in your frustration when you have to go pee, that reminded me that my son Rhett is now at the stage where like he sees me out in the garage. He goes in my tool cabinet and he keeps handing me screwdrivers. Like... It's slightly frustrating now because now I just have a pile of screwdrivers over here and he's like unorganizing my very organized toolbox, but it's kind of cool and kind of funny at the same time that he's like,
I have a question for you.
Yeah.
It's very cute. First of all, you need to train him on other tools so you can say wrench, you know,
exactly. And, you know. Yes. It's only the flatheads for some reason. I think he loves red. And so the Craftsman screwdrivers, the red ones are the flatheads, right?
Yeah.
So he will grab every single red screwdriver, the flathead ones.
I like my favorite screwdrivers are the Craftsmans that are red and blue and they're the round thing on the top and they're hex handles.
Yeah.
I love those. I feel like at some point they're going to go away. So I bought a couple and I don't use them. It's like a Phillips and a flathead, and
mine all have extra grip added to them because when I had Hank, the dog, he would chew on them and add a little extra grippage, which is
just cut your hand open
better or worse. Yep,
on the plastic of that stuff. So I have a question about your toolbox. You yelled at me when you were over here the other day. You said, there's no labels on your toolbox.
Dude, since I labeled everything, it's so nice.
Why?
And it's not for
I know
me.
Where everything is. Do you have dementia?
But if you ever have anyone else over, if you need anything in my garage,
here's the key.
You can just look at the labels.
Just
and you
live
got it.
Far enough away that nobody ever comes over.
Exactly.
And you don't have to label your toolbox.
Which, by the way, I'm coming over tomorrow night.
You are? What's tomorrow?
I am.
Tomorrow's Tuesday.
Tomorrow night, we have a big strategy meeting for Overcrest.
Oh, and you're going to come
hang
out.
I'm going to come up there and hang out. We'll do it in person.
So I'll have to set up another camera for you to be on Zoom. with.
Yes. The other. Anyway, why can't we just sit together? But yes,
I suppose we could do that. That would be fine.
That would be fine.
Tell me about the van. Okay. So I brought the van down, which is, it's a 1988.
Correct.
Chevy G20. I wish I had
a picture. Short wheelbase, Chris, mind you.
It is. Yes. I should have had some pictures ready.
This is coming out to the rally, of course, out to Oregon. So we need to make sure.
Our buddy Shane Senko is going to drive it. He's a vanner. Is it safe to say he's a vanner, right?
He's definitely a vanner. I'm chatting with him on Instagram, and he's got all the van. He's got a dedicated van page. He's definitely a vanner. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Okay.
So, So we needed to make sure that it was set to go, right? And so we.
How many miles round trip? 3,100 miles or
something. I thought it was more than that. Yeah, it's a lot.
I'm not even sure.
A lot of mileage. But we wanted to make sure it was set to go. So we brought it down to my place, and I have a mechanic friend down here. And I was like, yes, Chris and I can take the time. We know what we're doing. We can go through it. But you know what? Let's just pay this guy. These cheap vans. Guys always work on these Chevy vans. This shop knows them. Just bring it down there. Have them do a once over. The big thing, it's actually very, like, surprisingly,
3,600 miles round trip, plus other things.
Plus the rally itself going around to different places.
Yep.
Yeah, so I actually just got word he completely finished going through the rear axle already. Brand new everything, brake hardware in the rear, all set
to go
there.
This isn't what I care about.
No, but I did already receive all of the lowering parts for it.
How much lower is this thing going to be?
3 to 6 inches.
3 to 6 inches.
Depending, there's some adjustability that we can do.
That's anywhere from average to a lot, from what I read.
Yes, if you go more than that, you will rub everything.
Okay,
and we don't want that. We want it to still be drivable and easy, right? Why? What are you like scoffing at? Because we're not even driving it. Is that what you're laughing
no,
at?
It's, I said 3 to 6 inches is around average. You said any more than that, you start rubbing all over everything. I was like, yeah, absolutely. That sounds accurate.
Gotcha. Yes, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Okay, so it's going to be anywhere from 3 to 6 inches. That's a huge range. That is...
Right. Okay, well, let me tell you why. So we have 2.5-inch drop spindles going in the front, right? So that's without changing any geometry. It'll just lower the way
it sits. Is that kind of like doing drop plates on a rabbit? It's just like a thing, or is it actually the full spindle is
think
just
of,
longer?
Yes, the spindle. So think of like on the 911 when you do your RSR spindles, right? And it's just, it raises the actual height of the spindle, right?
Sure.
And so 2.5-inch spindles we got, drop spindles. And from there...
So that's 2.5 inches.
2.5 inches in the front right away. And from there, you do lowering springs. But I've been reading a lot. If you do the 2.5-inch drop spindles and like 3-inch lowering springs are standard, that's when you're rubbing on stuff in the front, right?
Okay.
So what my plan is we're going to do the 2.5-inch drop spindles, see where it's at, and then just cut the coils because it's not a progressive coil in these. Mm-hmm. It's a standard coil. So if you do it right, you can cut them and get it dialed in perfect. What I've also done, what I did with the C10, I did the same thing. I did 3-inch drop spindles on the C10, and I cut the coils and then added a coilover adjustable plate, spring perch, for the coil itself, so you have adjustability. So we could do that too if we don't get it dialed in on the first run. And then the rear, have leaf springs. Yep. You have leaf springs, so you do what's called an axle flip. So instead of the axle being below the leaf springs, you mount it on top of the leaf spring, and that draps it a bunch. However, that can get too low to the point where your axle is starting to start contacting the frame rail, and I don't want to do what's called a C-notch, where you literally... I've done that before.
And then you get a piece of pipe and you weld the piece of pipe in to make room for that.
Exactly. I don't really want to go that far on this thing. So what I then got is adjustable leaf spring drop links, or the leaf spring, whatever they're called. You know, it connects the leaf spring to the actual frame. So then we can basically bring the leaf spring back down to raise it to get more adjustability there. So yeah, so that's why it's a range. And that's
you
want
to
lower
to
it.
Do all of this stuff yourself.
Yeah, but which it sounds like my buddy is already done with the van, so we might be bringing it back, and I'll talk to him if he wants to tackle that. Maybe
why don't
I will
you
just
call
do
him
it.
And be, why don't you just drive over there with the big box of shit and be like, hey, man.
It was on my list to do this morning, and then
I had
like 50
someone
other
brings,
meetings, so yes.
When someone brings that stuff over, you're not bringing parts, you're bringing money. It's literally you're bringing a box of money to that person to do work.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's just take it over there and get it over with.
Yes. Okay. So that's the plan.
So what do we got going on the podcast today?
Yeah, we have Ravi Dalwani from CSF Cooling, CSF Radiators, CFS Race, and they do awesome custom radiators for all Overcrest sorts of rally applications.
Partner.
They are an Overcrest official rally partner. They actually have
he was gonna get a radiator going for the Driven to Death car.
Yeah.
And then it blew up. Because I have a I have a brass radiator in this car and it seeps and leaks.
Yeah.
I said, hey, why don't we get a good radiator in this thing? Like, I need to get a radiator.
Yes.
Let's talk to Robbie. Let's work something out.
And they're doing some really cool stuff. Well, now you need a BMW radiator, probably. But
Is that avoidable? From what I know, that's not a good idea. Don't all the BMWs blow
up? Well, I mean, it'll be a CSF radiator. But
yeah, so it'll be, it'll be good.
Yeah, so we have him coming on here, and it's going to be awesome because they have so many cool other projects that they're working on, like the 9/11 thing. I'm sure we're going to talk about here.
Yeah, we'll talk about all the different projects that they're working on. And I have questions about the, you know, a generational business. Too. Like, how does that work? Like, where does your business start? Where did it come from? And what does it take to, what does it take to continue to go from, I mean, old school to now? There's a huge breadth of business operations. I'd like to hear kind of how that was done and how the success that he has is, because they haven't always had a performance division either. So I'm really curious to see how that, that all came together. Before we get to that, what have you got for us?
Yeah, let's take a minute to talk about our sponsor, Petrolbox. Petrolbox is a monthly subscription made specifically for the automotive enthusiast. Chris, you were just wearing their t-shirt yesterday, I noticed,
in
your Instagram stories.
I was.
Each month, they have awesome stuff, including custom t-shirts. They have tools, garage gear, detailing supplies, stickers, like little cool metal enamel pins that you get every month. It's a cool curated selection of latest, greatest gear in the industry. You know, it's funny, I say it every month, that whatever tool or item I get, it's not something I would have normally purchased otherwise, but I always use it. Like, I was just using the plastic razor blade scraper kit that we got. There's one of the pins. That's a cool old Marlboro livery F1 car.
Focus.
Nope, focus. Not going to focus, but there you go. So they have awesome gear every month. Subscription service makes an awesome gift. Head over to mypetrolbox.com, Chris. It's mypetrolbox.com. Use code Overcrest at checkout for as little as $19.95 a month. You can get signed up. Otherwise, the Petrolbox Premium gets you even more gear for $39.95 a month. Check those guys out.
All right. Let's get on the horn with Ravi. Ravi, how's it going, man?
It's good. It's good, Chris. How you doing?
Good. It's good to see your face and not talk to you when it's like 3 o'clock in the morning or London or wherever you were last time.
Yeah, no, definitely. I know when we started to kick things off and talk about, you know, coming on the podcast and working with Overcrest. Yeah, definitely some late hours between the time change of where I was in Europe versus where you guys have been. So
that's how it goes, though, man. This is like this job. And obviously, I guess I would consider you self-employed as the owner of a company. I guess you're a self-employed guy. It never ends. There's no time off. The phone's always doing shit. It is so hard to step away. I mean, it's just all the time.
Yeah, it's really hard to switch off too, like as an owner, because you know, if you do decide to switch off, it's negatively affecting your company and the productivity. So it's kind of like sometimes, you know, I'd be like, oh, I gotta get that done. You just gotta get up and sack it up and do it, right? Otherwise you're missing a whole day, or you know, even sometimes 2 days if you're trying to talk to somebody overseas or in a different time zone. So yeah, you just got to grind it out and do whatever it takes.
Yeah, for sure. So I was looking, I went on your website and I want to pull up this picture quick. Let me see if I can share my screen. Where is it?
Maybe,
right here.
Maybe.
This picture right here. What am I looking at with this photo?
Yeah.
First of all, it's a photo of an old, you know, just talk us through this. What do we got?
Yeah, so that is a garage in the city of Bombay, India, which is now Mumbai. So this was taken in the 40s. So I believe this is like early 1941-ish. And that's my great-grandfather on the left. And that's my grandfather and his two brothers and then one of their other employees on the right. And that's pretty much how TSF got started. So we were a Dunlop tire dealer in the middle of the city. And we were also started to get the reputation of where to take your radiator to get repaired. You know, back then it was all copper brass. You know, you needed somebody who knew how to solder a radiator. And that's essentially how we got our start. And as the notoriety of, you know, hey, this is a place to go, we decided, hey, maybe we can start making radiators.
So there's more money in radiators than there is in tires at the time.
I think they're both pretty slim margin at this point. So
okay.
A lot of volume, but definitely, you know, as the world becomes more, I guess, global and you can get parts and, you know, kind of circumvent a lot of, you know, traditional distribution channels, it definitely has gotten more competitive on that end. But yeah, so that's a picture of like the early 40s.
So your great grandfather started this shop. Like, this is his shop
in India,
along with my the next generation, his son.
The next generation. So that's four generations now. What was the car world like in India? I'm just imagining, like, what kind of cars is everybody driving over there?
Probably the same shit they're driving now. A bunch of those, like, books and, like, you know, it's just, there a lot of the cars were probably British, right? Because that was coming off the British Empire. And, there was obviously some Indian versions. You have, like, you know, extensions of, like, what you have now, like Tata Motors and some of those cars. To be honest, I have no idea what the cars would look like. But every major manufacturer was there, you know, Mercedes, Volvo, a lot of the German brands were there. So, everyone kind of just doing kind of what they're doing in China now, like kind of setting up a subsidiary and like a joint venture, joint partnership, and making cars for the domestic market.
So when I think of dudes in India working on cars, like I see craftsmen in some of these countries that just work their ass off, right? These dudes like work with their hands. They got a different work ethic. I'm just imagining the foundation of CSF being like a really hardworking group of guys. You know, like, so how did that end up coming to America? Like that vibe and that work ethic?
Yeah. So, you know, we have the factory in India and we actually still own and operate that factory. My great uncle, who's in that picture, is still operating that factory. He's
what?
Like 89 years old and he's in there. He's working.
You ever go over there? You go visit him?
I haven't been back in about 10 years, but that's actually where we're starting to make a lot of the new parts. So it's actually pretty cool. So a lot of our air-cooled parts that we're coming out with and some other like vintage models, that factory is extremely technical. We have a lot of OEM clients and they're able to really kind of make something at a robust level that I'm pretty happy with. And plus, it's pretty cool that I'm doing a project with my great uncle, kind of like tying some of the generations. So
what does he think of the company now? Because obviously you guys are huge. You've got a performance division. You're doing all kinds of new stuff. I mean, I'm looking at this picture of these dudes just sitting there, you know, sitting on tires in a shop that you can't put a car in. You can't. I mean, this isn't a shop like a shop. It's a storefront where they sell radiators and tires, fix stuff in the back, whatever, mount tires.
Yeah.
Now, holy shit.
We were mounting tires in the street back in that picture, right? So it got
right.
Up.
Wow.
So just to answer, go back to your question. So when my father came to the United States, he came to Long Beach State for his engineering degree. And when he came for his engineering degree, he decided to stay. So that's how basically CSF started in the U.S. We started exporting all of our production from India. And then we actually, at the same time, we're opening up a factory in Singapore. We use that as kind of like the manufacturing point to ship to the United States. And whereas in India, we're primarily like an OE supplier, here in the States, we're more of like an aftermarket replacement company. So, you know, we have so many different makes and models, anything from, you know, an F-150, F-250, all the way to Toyota Camry and Honda Civics, right? So, and the business here is like tons of volume, low margin. At least that's what his business is. I mean, some months he's selling like 50,000 pieces. So my father's done, you know, very well for himself, wildly successful. We have two warehouses, one in California, one in Virginia. And then
when he moved here and he went to Long Beach State and started doing his engineering degree, was he thinking he was going to continue this line of work or was he thinking he was going to be an engineer and do something else? Like, do you know, like how did that?
I think he kind of knew that, like, hey, I'm gonna be in this business. You know, I have this foundation. It's a family business. You know, he was a third generation, and I think there's a lot of pride for us in the family because not, you know, you have so many cousins and so many different people, but like only a few of us have decided to continue to do this. Like, I'm the only one from my generation who has, you know, decided to put the work in and continue to, you know, follow down this path. So I think he knew he wanted to do it, but really it takes time, just like for myself, is like what avenue you're going to go. Yeah, we make cooling system, but there's a lot of different directions you can go with that.
For sure.
So he kind of latched on to the aftermarket replacement. And the way his business grew was he was the first company to have import replacements. That was the same time Honda, Datsun, and Toyota started importing the cars into America.
So we're talking 60s, 70s, like
exactly
late 60s. Okay.
And all of the companies in the U.S. who were making radiators were only making them for domestic cars because that's all they had here. So he was the first company to have import vehicles. So he was always known as the import vehicle specialist. So all the way up until about the early 2000s, he only concentrated on import vehicle aftermarket. So most distributors, you know, especially before the internet kind of like changed the game, would have a domestic line, and then they were forced to find an offering for the import line that was continuing to grow and grow exponentially in the U.S. That's how CSF really started to gain a lot of momentum and traction, you know, with how he grew his business.
So is that why he decided to stay, do you think? Did he see that opportunity? Like, whoa, nobody's doing this shit over here. I'm going to stay here. Let's go.
I think there's that. I also think when he came, obviously Long Beach State in the 70s is a pretty cool place to grow up and experience things, you know, and you know, like it's always been like everybody still talks about like the American dream. And I think going back and kind of working within the confines of who's running the show in India, it's like there's always can only be so many chiefs, right? You're always going to be working for somebody else. He really wanted to step out and do his own thing. And, you know, similar to how then I decided in 2010 when I graduated from university that, hey, I wanted to kind of get in the business, but I didn't really gravitate to what he was doing because to me that just felt like very commoditized, right? Like it's a box and people just need replacement radiators. And I really wanted to take it to the next level of higher engineering, more custom, more boutique. And I wanted it to be something I could sell globally to the best cars in the world, right? And that's why I decided.
Where did that passion come from for you? Like, was there, growing up around cars, obviously you're growing up around this company, right? So there's cars all the time, everywhere. Were you, you know, obviously.
Yeah, that doesn't mean that your parents were enthusiasts, right?
Yeah, so like, where does this passion come from?
Well, so actually, ironically, my dad had a silver 81 SC, which is kind of how I modeled my 911 build that I made. It's silver. It's an 82. Started off as an 82 SC, but really, I mean, I think it came from Fast and the Furious and taking auto shop in high school, to be honest. So, you know, I grew up, I graduated high school in 2005. That was kind of like the peak of like high, or like, I guess the start of the run of like, you know, Fast and Furious coming out and what a trend that was. Thankfully fortunately my high school actually had auto shop, which I know of many high schools don't have anymore. So, you know, and we were able to take the class for repeated credit. So I was like always taking auto shop and, you know, working on my own car, working on my friends' cars. And I just liked that aspect of, you know, high performance car culture, especially the Honda scene. You know, like that's how I grew up. I was a Honda kid, you know, coming from Southern California. That's what we still do. Right. We're still big into that old 90s era Honda community. So I did that. I went to college and
hold on. So this automotive shop at your high school, this is something that it's fading, right? This is not something that's in shop class, automotive tech in school. What did that give you what did you get out of that? What do you think most kids get out of that? And what are we missing in high school by not having that there anymore?
I think there's such a trend that moves towards digital, right? Even textbooks are now all digital. You're getting away from like the work and the analog and the way of doing things. And it's really about like starting something and finishing something, right? And if you don't do it right, your car's not leaving. You might have to come back after school and the guy will stay and you're going to have to figure out.
If you don't finish it, it doesn't work. You hear this?
That's fine. I have an extra stall. The car's on my hoist in my garage. Doesn't matter. Yeah. We're good.
You know, and it was cool because we set up in teams, and I'm actually still good friends with some of the guys. I got like teamed up with Auto Shop, and we would do stupid shit like buy like a golf cart off of eBay that didn't work, and we would like spray paint the thing and, you know, try to get it to work, and, you know, and then we were changing gauges in our cars. I was putting cold air intakes off, you know, I put underglow under my Honda, you know, putting Alpine flip up screen, you know, remote start buttons for no reason. Like we would just do stupid shit that we could buy on the internet that we saw in the movie. We're like, oh, this is pretty cool. Let's do this, you know? And then I needed, like, we always had to be doing something, and you would get so many points, and you have to have at the end of the week, how many points did you accomplish in auto shop? So if it was a more intensive job, you get more points. If it was an oil change, you get like one or two. But yeah, you just kind of learn how to work on a car. And I think everybody who maybe goes into a family business or who has the opportunity to go into some type of family business sometimes maybe resist it because they feel like they're going to be, you know, the shadow of the company or the family, and they might want to branch out and do something else. And I kind of felt like that for a little bit. But once I kind of saw that, hey, I can do this entire high performance division and maybe even branch out and just do my own thing, I kind of came back to it. So when I graduated college, I said, hey, let me see if I can get this thing off the ground. And it took like about 5 years to do it. I almost actually quit because it was going so slow and it wasn't really what I thought it was going to be.
Why do you think that was? Why was it going so slow initially?
I think I had to have a big slice of humble pie. Whereas, you know, and kind of understanding like the distribution structure and what people know CSF for. At that time, people knew CSF as an OEM replacement aftermarket alternative, right? When I go into a high performance shop and I say, hey, you know, with a CSF logo on my shirt, I'm here from CSF. They go, well, who the fuck are you? They don't know who CSF is in racing, right? And they don't know it in high performance. So that was like
Who's your competitor then? Was it like Mishimoto or something?
Yeah,
or what's the?
You know, really, we got compared to like Koyo, Mishimoto, right? Because I obviously, coming from the import world, started to make import applications. My father had a lot of designs for OEM replacement in import that I was able to look at first. And, you know, back then, I think people looked at it as like, we already have two import lines. We have Koyo, Mishimoto. Where do you fit in, right? So I was always getting that. I was literally getting that answer every single distributor or dealer I went to. They were like, we already have the brands we sell. We don't really need another one, right? And it took some time for me to come out with applications first to market for people really to notice that, hey, this company is not just chasing other competitors that have been doing it for a while, but they're actually coming out with new stuff first. So once I started to come out with new applications, is really where people were kind of forced to, you know, recognize the brand and try it because there was no alternative. And that's really what started to happen.
You said you already had a lot of the OEM replacements for some of these applications and you were working on more of the high performance. What really is the distinction there? Like, what makes a high performance radiator versus the OEM replacement?
So, you know, I think the most obvious difference is an OEM replacement will typically be like plastic tanks crimped onto like an aluminum core, whereas a high performance radiator will be like an all aluminum radiator that's TIG welded to the core. So it's, you know, it's stronger, less chance of leak. And then, you know, sometimes it's made wider or thicker. You know, you might go from like a one row to a two row. And then the last thing, you know, which people who aren't in the business might not be able to catch is the specification of the core, right? What is like the fin spec, the tube spec, what makes it a bigger radiator or a better radiator, not just like how wide it is, right? How thick it is. So, you know, there's levels of engineering where I think sometimes the mass market doesn't realize what goes into a good radiator. And you know, they kind of just fall for marketing, or they just kind of, you know, fall for what they know as like, oh, the widest, the bigger and thicker it is, the better it must be, right? So we've had to fight. So we've had to fight a lot of these things in terms of like kind of teaching potential consumers why they should be buying a CSF product versus an alternative.
I was gonna ask,
one of the biggest benefits go ahead, Jake.
I was just gonna say, was that part of, I guess, what finally got you to grow beyond, you know, that first 5 year grind, was maybe like the education of the industry saying, you know, here is what makes it different and here's why our products are good?
I would say the education helps. I also would say one of the things that really started to get the brand noticed was who was using it. I was very fortunate to team up, you know, at that time, Formula Drift was probably at its peak with a couple of drift teams that kind of gave me a chance. Bergenholz Racing was one of my, you know, first like professional race teams that they allowed us to sponsor them. The other one was Michael Essa and his Formula Drift team. And when Michael Essa won that year the championship, we had done all this cooling, and there was several rounds during that season where it was extremely hot. And his car never overheated, whereas the competitors he was lined up with were sponsored by my competitors, and they would have to be taking timeouts between the runs because their cars were overheating. So some subtle stuff like that started to happen. Some Porsche guys went out to like Global Time Attack, and it was like 110 degrees at Buttonwillow, but they were able to go the entire 30-minute session and not pull off. And, you know, the rest of the Porsche guys come out and they'll be like, hey, how the hell were you out there the whole time? Was your car not overheating? And they're like, no, I got these new radiators from CSF. They're like, who's CSF? And, you know, that name just kind of like starts to trickle out there. So it takes a lot of time. I also was very young when I started. So, you know, I was 21 when I started my business. I think one thing my father did was he gave me a little bit of money to start it. And then he kind of said, hey, listen, I'm here to help you, but you're kind of on your own. You're going to have to figure this out. And to be honest, he doesn't really, even till this day, you know, whenever we talk, sometimes he tells me what to do, but like, he's so disconnected from this industry that I'm in now that I'm like, that's terrible advice. You know, because you just don't get like the level that we're at and like what it takes to kind of sell at this like top level versus mass market selling it out, whether it's marketing, engineering, the testing, all those things. You know, we just have to really make sure whatever we're selling is going to be legit. So I've had to learn a lot, you know, throughout the almost 15 years I've been doing this.
What would you tell 21-year-old Ravi right now? What would turn things around a little earlier, do you think?
Ask more questions to people in the industry of where you want to be. Like, I wish I started networking more when I was younger and kind of reaching out to more people and asking them some questions. And I did that a little bit, but I wish I would have done a little bit more. And I think for where we're at, I wish I would have understood how distribution works. Like, I wasn't able to grasp back then what a distributor was, what a dealer is, who buys parts from where, how that whole value chain exists, because I would go to shops and I would be selling radiators on like eBay. And, you know, that's like the onesies and the twosies. Maybe a shop calls you or like a website calls you. I need one. I sold a drop ship. But like, when you can
that's get like direct to consumer, right? Talking like,
or like a two step level, right? To like a dealer who's got a shop, right? Like a shop owner who needs a radiator. You know, maybe you would convince them to buy a radiator every once and then. But like, if you can get into mass distribution where guys are buying pallets and, you know, millions of dollars of your product a year and shipping it to their network of dealers and shops, that's really what I took a couple of years to kind of grasp. And I think if I would have been able to grasp that a little earlier, maybe it would give me a faster runway.
Yeah. How has the explosion of social media and influencers changed the business for you? Because it seems like, I don't know, maybe 5 years ago, it wasn't something that anybody was doing. Now it's everywhere.
Yeah. I mean, a perfect example, like a minute before I walked in here, my general manager is like, hey, look at this girl. She's got a YouTube following and she's got a TV show. Like, she's asking for a Tacoma rated, or what do you think? I'm like, yeah, go ahead and give it to her. You know, I mean, 5 years ago, we actually kind of resisted this. You know, we thought it was kind of a joke. I was like, all these YouTubers, like, are they serious? Like, I don't find it, I mean, you know, to be a serious thing. Why am I going to go give them free product? But it's really changed the game, you know? And to be fair, it's actually a much more cost-effective way of marketing. Like, if you can vet these people properly and you can kind of hold their feet to the fire on deliverables, you know, giving somebody a radiator that costs $300 or $400 for the reach that they have into that core market is way cheaper than taking a magazine ad out. You know, like, who's reading magazines anymore, right? And, you know,
or $300 in Facebook marketing, which is just like,
doesn't get you anywhere.
Doesn't work.
You know, so I mean, you remember like the days of magazines of like Source Interlink.
Oh yeah.
You know, they would charge you like $5,000 for a page and some of these like imports.
That's bullshit, because they were only paying me $300 for a photo shoot.
Yeah.
What the hell?
Yeah.
Holy shit.
That's also why they've gone out of business twice over, three times over, right? So I think, you know, what you're able to get with the new ways of marketing, obviously, you can reach the world in a much bigger scale and a lot quicker, like, especially if something goes viral. I mean, look at Instagram. I mean, that shit's free for the most part. And if you have good content, people will find it. Now, we do all of it, though, still. I still advertise in magazines. I still believe in print. I'm one of probably the last few, especially from a younger generation that I'm in, that actually believes in print. I find there to be a huge value to the brand. And I think there is a barrier to print where you have to be putting your skin in the game. So it's really more of like a major manufacturer type deal. And we want to support these publications because they're the ones who also have the barrier of what's good and what's bad. Anyone can put a photo shoot on the internet and see it. But when you're looking at a high level of print, it's like, hey, they like enough of what we're doing, like whether it's a car that we've built or a project that we've been a part of, that they're like, we want to feature this. People are paying for this magazine, and we think whatever your work is good enough for people to get their value out of it. So I still enjoy print. I still read print. There's a few
magazines. Hey, if you're print and you're still standing at this point, I mean, good on you, man. Yeah. I mean, it's tough. It's tough out there. So I think that, you know, picking up print and seeing, like, now that it's condensed, right? You don't have, like, Eurotuner, Eurocarp, like, all these different, like, little things that are all split up. It's all the shitty paper, like, where it's, you can see through it. It's so thin, and all these magazines are all gone. And what's left seems to be, I know that some of them are still dying and a lot of them are really starving, but some of them that are still left are, like, really high quality publications, and being part of that is special.
Yeah, I agree. And you're right. They've all kind of merged and consolidated, and, like, it's like any business, right? And especially in the aging business, the best will survive. And I think that's really what you're getting. I think you're actually seeing, like, the golden era of print, to be honest, right? Like, if you actually pick up something that's a very high quality print magazine or book, you're kind of, like, amazed at, like, what's gone into it, right?
Yeah.
The work is great. The quality of the paper or the book and everything is good, you know? So, you know, and that's this type
you
of
can
stuff
even that, like, smelling, yeah. I know it sounds weird, but, like, smelling like a high quality print magazine. Yeah. I like the smell of, like, it. There's a difference between something printed, like, in the doldrums of some country, and then something that's printed, like, in Germany or America, and it's well done and I don't know, well bound. It's good.
Yeah. So, you know, I think there's levels of all these different things that you can do for marketing. I think we do a pretty good job at marketing. I wouldn't say we're the best, because some people have really figured it out and I'm still trying to really figure out the matrix, but, you know, we do our best.
It's an enigma right now, man.
Yeah.
Like, all this influencer stuff, like, people are asking me to do stuff all the time. I'm like, I don't even know what to charge anybody. There's, like, no metrics. There's no compass for this. There's nothing. Nobody knows what's going on. It's like this giant chaotic wild, wild west situation.
You know, and we get guys, I mean, we make, like, parts that are like $7,000 billet intake manifolds, right? And you'll get some, you know, BMW customer who wants this, but he wants it sponsored. And we're, like, having to look at this guy's following and be like, is it even worth, like, can we even justify giving something like this away to somebody? Yep. And then it also becomes like, what do people perceive the value if you just gave them $7,000 of free stuff, one part, right?
Sure.
Like, does that person even value the brand? Or is he just looking for free stuff? He's obviously trying to, like, shoot a shot. And what are we going to do, right? So we're very selective on who we work with. It doesn't have to be somebody with the biggest reach, because I think we're more quality than quantity. Because we're selling a high level of motorsports cooling, right? It's pretty niche. So, yeah, every street guy can put it on his car. But if he's shouting and he's a vlogger and really it's just people watching it for entertainment, it's really not our audience anyways, right? So there has to be a balance of, like, how many people are actually potential customers who may be watching this or listening to this versus how many people are just watching it to consume it as entertainment. And
right.
I think that's what's really changed, because, you know, the younger generation, they just watch YouTube as their preferred method of watching content, right? They'll watch a million things. How much of it are they actually really digesting and making it as like a informed purchasing decision? That I don't have the answer. So we're just trying to use that. And I guess it's all based on experience, you know, like.
I think you got the golden goose in Mike. I mean, Mike is the real deal. People that follow Mike and his Ferrari build and everything.
Yeah.
I mean, I think what he's doing is incredible. Speaking of that, like, what is SEMA like? You know, because I see, like, guys that are at SEMA, and you got the SEMA booth and the SEMA cars, and I'm like, what goes into having, like, a CSF booth and all that stuff? Is it worth it? Is it difficult? You've been doing it for a long time.
Yeah, this is going to be my 13th year with a booth at SEMA. And I've actually done, like, blogs and some educational, you know, informative seminars for, like, younger owners, because I get a lot of younger guys hitting me up saying, hey, they're kind of intimidated by the idea of going to SEMA, and they don't know how much it costs. They don't know how to do it effectively. And I've always tried to, like, give back to the next generation, right, of the younger guys or whatever I've learned, because, you know, older guys have helped me too, you know. So we all, if we want this industry to continue to evolve, we have to be able to support it, especially with the challenges we have of younger generations not really being into automotive as much as they are into tech. The guys who are into automotive, we better help them succeed so we do have the next generation of enthusiasts and manufacturers that come out of that. So I think when you go to SEMA, you see some of these displays. Some of these guys are spending $250,000, $500,000, millions of dollars. And to me, it's a complete waste of time. It's a waste of time, waste of money, because, like, you see, like, okay, perfect example, the hanging signs over the booth, right?
Yeah.
It's easy to find somebody because they have the hanging sign over the booth. Just to hang that sign is $4,000.
Okay. Just for the privilege.
Just for the union to hang your sign, it's $4,000. Okay. Then you have to make the sign. So whatever the cost of that is, I'm sure that's a few thousand dollars anyways, right? And then you have to transport it because everything's unionized. So they have something called the material handling fee. So however much your stuff weighs, all your booth, all the stuff that's in your booth, the hanging signs, whatever, once it goes in the door, they weigh your stuff. And they charge you a per pound fee. So then you have a material handling fee based on the size of your booth and how much shit you're bringing in the door. Could be anywhere between $3,000 and $50,000, right?
So that's walk around with holes in your pockets, man. Yeah. You go in there, it's just like all your changes have fallen out into your socks.
So when I first started, I was too poor to pay the material handling fee. I didn't have any money. I actually hand carried all my parts. I would park my car like a quarter or a half mile away, and I would have a little dolly, and I would just have a bunch of $5 bills and $10 bills, and I would just bribe everybody to open doors to get me to where I needed with my thing. And it would take me like 2.5 days longer to set up my booth, but I would do it on the cheap, right? And I actually used the exact same booth from year one. I haven't upgraded my booth. I haven't done anything. I just changed the signs, make it look a little prettier. I've kind of just refurbished it. No one ever took, I always tell people, I always laugh. I said, no one ever took a picture of the hanging sign and it went viral. They only care about the cars you bring to SEMA. So you can punch well above your weight by just selecting the right cars. Because if you have the right cars, people will come find your booth to look at those, right? And I think that is probably the biggest lesson I can always give to people is be really selective of what you're showing and also do a lot of pre-show reach out and post-show follow-up. Like you can get a lot of marketing out of it by the cars you bring, but if you're going to look for qualified buyers who actually are interested in purchasing your parts, yes, the car will draw them in and maybe they'll ask questions or maybe they'll be like, oh, I've never heard of this brand. What do they do? But you really need to be setting up meetings every half hour, every 1 hour with people that potentially could be buying your products. There's a lot of international business that comes to SEMA, especially it's starting to come, post pandemic. And we don't do the, hey, just come by the booth and let us know, or just kind of hit us up, let us know when you're coming by. We say, hey, no, we want to know a schedule. When can you come by? And you hope that those guys show up on time because my schedule for SEMA, I literally have a meeting every half hour for 5 days. Like we even start meetings the day before, like I'm paying money to be there. I'm going to get all the juice out of the lemon in terms of trying to get the most business possible, you know? So I would say post show follow up, you know, I pass that out to some of my sales guys. I'm like, hey guys, this is the meeting we had. Give these guys a few days to get home, unwind and kind of digest their own business. But we got to make sure we don't like fall off on, you know, what we talked about. Otherwise, what was the point of going to the show?
So sometimes it seems like it's just like, going to SEMA for some companies and some, it's just like this masturbatory thing where they're just there to be there. And like, look, we're here.
That's why the booths are so big because they all have marketing budgets and if they don't use it, they lose it, right? Like they don't get to like push it off to next year and say, hey, let's save our money for another project. Like they earmark these things. Sometimes these companies are so tunnel vision on what they do, they continue to do the same thing. So I look at these companies and go, wow, you spend $400,000 at SEMA. And people think we spend like over hundreds of thousands of dollars because they see the cars, they see how much marketing we get. They're like, wow, CSF blew it up at SEMA. It's like, no, I bring the same dingy booth. I make it look a little nice. I bring the right cars and I put a lot of time and effort with my staff on who we're meeting with. And that's how we really succeed at SEMA. And that's how we're able to do other marketing events throughout the year, not just blow all of it at SEMA. Right. So
it seems crazy to imagine a budget when I know this is like government budgeting too. If you don't spend it, it's gone. Why wouldn't you just be like, hey, do this ratio of like, here's what you spent, here's what you got in a return for it. Maybe if there's some left over, if you meet this, why don't we give a bonus? What are we doing? Why are we just like blowing all this money out the door?
Because you have it's just like government spending. A lot of people need to justify their jobs. The marketing people need to justify their jobs. So if they're not going out there and doing this grand show at SEMA and like, hey, and you know, the graphic designer for the company is not doing a bunch of graphics and new shirts and new designs and all that stuff, then at some point a manager is going to look at them and go, hey, maybe you're not really needed here. We didn't really use you much last year. Right. So I think it's
just
part of the corporate culture where people start to just, their companies grow and everyone just kind of just does what they do. And it just kind of like the same thing over and over again. And there's not a lot of innovation. me as a younger owner, me as an enthusiast, me as somebody who's in the trenches with my staff. Like, I mean, I've been doing this for almost 15 years. We run this place like a startup. You know, everyone's expected to come to work every day and just grind it out. Like, we're going to win on talent and we're going to win on hard work. You know, I mean, that's really what I try to emphasize to my guys. And we may not be the most talented, but we're going to win on hard work, right? So we're just trying our best to kind of do that all together. But we always have a meeting 1 week before SEMA. And I sit down all my guys and I say, guys, the objective at SEMA every year is not the same. And if you go into it, like you say, like this mandatory task of like, we're just spinning the wheels and we're going back, you're not going to do well at the show. Like, what are we here for? Are we here for marketing? Are we here for international outreach? Are we here to connect with our current dealers? Are we looking for new customers? Do we have new products that we're trying to find those customers? You have to have a mission. So when random people come in the booth and they're asking questions, my whole staff is keyed into, what are we looking for? And are these the right guys? Like, did we just find a golden goose at SEMA that we weren't expecting? Some of my biggest deals have come from the SEMA show. So I'm very, very pro SEMA, where I think a lot of people, especially through COVID and the pandemic, like the automotive aftermarket just boomed. And a lot of people thought they didn't need it anymore. They're like, oh, we saved so much money with the show not coming this year. We don't need to go back. And you've seen a couple of these companies say, we're out. We're not coming back. And I feel like you got to support the organization. I mean, this is the organization that supports us. Kind of yep. Like, you know, back to that print example, if we don't support it, there will be no SEMA show. And then one day we're all going to be twiddling our thumbs and be like, wow, I wish it was a trade show for the industry so we could all connect and, you know, get yeah. together. And it's not just SEMA too. I mean, you also have PRI, right? Which is a yep. whole, which serves a completely different purpose. I think those are two very different shows that get very different people to come through the doors. I mean, yeah, obviously there's a little bit of an overlap, but I think they're both really important.
So when I was at SEMA, your booth was great. And then I walked through the door like a little bit to whichever direction, because that place is like, dude, I get lost so easy. And I walked up to this booth, and what it was, there was nobody there. They had a black curtain like on like C-stands, and they had like a table with a tablecloth on it. And on this tablecloth was a suitcase-shaped thing with an electric motor attached to it. But and there was no one there. And there's like a little business card that says like universal EV conversion, blah, blah, blah. And it was like a few different things stacked out on the table. And I was like, wow, this is the saddest booth ever. But at some point, whatever company this is, if they do it right, this style of thing is going to be one of the biggest things at the show, is these boutique EV conversions, or maybe like universal EV conversions. And while you were talking about this stuff, it made me think of the evolution of where SEMA can go and where it can go. And then I started thinking about where can you guys go? Like as we shift into EV and stuff like that. I mean, what do you guys do? Is obviously in the next 15, 20 years, no problem. I mean, everybody's still driving cars with radiators. But long term, as you're getting ready to retire or sell the business and stuff like that, what is the value of CSF going to be? What are you guys going to do as the industry evolves?
Yeah. So number one, nobody in my family retires. We all die working. That's kind of how the way. No, my dad's 70 years old, almost 70 years old. He still runs his company. He comes in every day to work. So, you know, that's just what it is. You know, my grandfather died working. My great uncle's 89. He can't stop working. Right. So I plan on doing this for a lot longer than just 15, 20 years. Right. So we obviously yeah. have to evolve now.
Right.
Kind of touching on what you said about electric cars, I've made a commitment and I've already told my staff every year we're going to have an electric vehicle in the booth. So this year we have an electric vehicle in the booth. We are actively looking for more electric vehicle companies. They have like the Electrified Expo that's going around the country right now. We went to the one in Long Beach to talk to some of these kit builders. All of these electric cars need cooling. There are radiators, yep. there are heat exchangers, there's Freon cooling. And we want to be a part of
it. How is it different than like a regular radiator? Because I'm imagining, are they kind of like side mount intercooler type things? Are they tucked away? How is it different than what you guys are doing?
Tesla has like two, it's almost like a Porsche setup. They have like two right underneath like the headlights. So they have two radiators there. And I've actually learned quite a bit and I'm very intrigued by it through my friend Ryan, who owns RyeWire. He's done a lot of like electric conversions, like on an S2K, he'll be doing a Porsche build, and some of it's Freon cooled. So there's like a four-way valve. So you actually use the, it's like a Freon to water cooler. So you use the Freon from the AC system to chill down the water to like like below freezing, and that's what's going through and cooling the battery. So there's like a jacket around the battery and the water cools around it, but you need to cool the batteries. It could be one or two. You got to cool the motors. It could be like a front dual motor system, like for the front and back. You need to cool the batteries and you need to cool the stator. So there's a lot of cooling with like different circuits, independent circuits that need to happen. There's a lot of opportunity out there for a cooling company to kind of do that. And that's what we're trying to do.
Sounds like some crazy tooling up for that. That sounds wild.
Yeah. And just from the technical perspective, why do they need to use the Freon, or why are they doing that rather than just having a standard, you know, air to water heat exchanger? Is it because they need to get colder than we can do with ambient, or what is the point of that?
Pretty much. And like from people I've talked to who work at Tesla, they've told me that range and power is all limited by how hot the batteries are getting. Like, so the cooler you can make, to a point, right? There's like this optimal range of like, if it gets too hot, it's bad. If it gets too cold, it's bad, right? So you need to get into this optimal range. But, you know, we learned a lot working with like the Evasive Motorsports Pikes Peak Tesla Model 3. We did a custom cooling kit on that. I've done stuff for Unplugged Performance in the past. You know, they've been doing a lot of Teslas. We have a couple... we have like an EV battery packager company that we're now making custom products for, and they have the stuff in like an EV tractor, and they have the products in like an EV UTV, like an off-road vehicle. So, you know, we're looking at using these companies who've come to us because we do a ton of private label. We do a ton of private label, a ton of custom manufacturing, like on short, medium run scale stuff. And we're actively looking for these types of customers.
So, do you want to talk a little bit about the Porsche project you guys have been working on with the new stuff, or is that top secret for now? Or
we can
talk about the new cooler.
Yeah, absolutely. So, we are working on the 911 engine case cooler. So this is the cooler.
So we're all air cooled 911s.
Pretty much everything from like the one that we're working on right now is 63 to 89, and we've made it a multi fit. There's actually an early version with like an M30 fitting on it. And then there's like a later version with like a slip on hose, but we've made one cooler that works with both.
I don't have good experiences with slip on hoses, man.
So, we've been working on this for a couple of years now. There's been a lot of tooling that's gone into it, a lot of testing in our labs. And we've got a couple of them that are going to be on debut at Rennsport, at our booth, and also with MP, they're actually building a running engine in their booth, which is actually going to be pretty neat, and our cooler is going to be mounted to it. So it'll be running all weekend, and then probably around October, November, the parts will be for sale. But part of the thing that I'm trying to do, especially with this, you know, I guess where the market's going in 10 years, essentially there may not be new ICE engines to make cooling for. So unless we innovate into electric, or go backwards and start making products for older cars that we know we don't make now, essentially my business can become a classic car business. And we want to make parts for all the cars where there's still a demand, but there's no OE supply. So we're really pushing on the CSF Classic line that we've been developing for the last couple of years. That's why I built my 911, is just to be able to use it as a branding tool and awareness tool. But we already have...
That's a hell of a branding tool, man. That thing is awesome.
Hopefully, as the owner, you get to have fun with your branding tools, right? So I don't have to go to some bean counter and justify what I'm doing. So, and I can take some of that marketing money that I've saved from, instead of having a huge booth at SEMA, and put it into, you know, some cars. So,
And you can go on the Overcrest rally. It's perfect.
The Overcrest rally, you know? So we have the right fender oil cooler already. We have all like the IROC and RS style center oil coolers already. Now we have the engine case cooler coming.
Is that case cooler? They're all toast. Like every single bare cooler is like, mine was in a cleaner, like an ultrasonic thing for like 7 months to like get it clean. And my car, it runs great, but like those bare coolers are worn out, broken, leaking. There's no more. What's out there is what's out there. That's it.
Yeah. And if you can find a new one, like they're still making them in very, very small amounts. If you can find a new one, they're about $1,300 US, right? So $1,300. But you're essentially buying something that was made 50 years ago. So it's a good cooler, but you're not, there's nothing great about the cooler compared to modern technology. And that cooler wasn't really designed for like modern resto mod engines either. Right. So that's really where we wanted to step in and really create like an OEM plus replica that looks the part, but it works phenomenally. Lower pressure drop, higher performance, sheds the heat a lot faster than the original. And that's kind of what we're trying to step in and have it available all the time and at a better price. Right. So that's how we want to be able to hit the market. So that's the story on the Porsche Cooler. I'm really excited about it. I've been working for it about 2 years.
Cool.
I've been working on it with my great uncle, you know, so kind of reconnecting generations. They're really all excited about it because it's kind of, you know, a little bit different than the mundane, you know, OE agricultural industrial stuff that we typically do from that factory. So yeah, it's
ooh, what about a Porsche tractor cooler?
there you go.
If people want it, we'll make it, you know? So yeah, absolutely.
Well, dude, I appreciate you coming to hang out with us. It was a good time. I look forward to seeing you. I'll come find you at Rennsport. I'm going to drive my car out and we'll see you there. And then 2 weeks later, we'll see you at the Overcrest Rally. And then 2 weeks later, I'll see you at SEMA.
Yep.
So we'll get to see a lot of each other. I'll work on trying to build a car that's worthy of a SEMA booth. I'll see what I can do.
Ooh.
Everything usually ends up being a little bit too much of a shit box, but yeah, I don't know. We'll see.
Very cool. Well, I appreciate you guys having me on the podcast. This has been fun. And yeah, I'm really excited to do more with you guys, especially going the rally. You know, I was driving my car a little bit this weekend and it's like, there's always so much you can drive it, right? I mean, you can't really rip on it that hard. And I can't wait to, you know, get on the rally and just really enjoy it for a prolonged period of time with some, you know, fellow enthusiasts who are excited to be there.
It's interesting when you hop in your car, even when I hop in my car here and you drive it to the store, you drive it to dinner, or you just maybe you even go for like a little bit of a spirited drive. It takes way longer than that to get into this rally zone.
Yeah.
I mean, it takes a few, probably 2, 3, 4 hours of driving before you forget that you're going to do something and then you're just doing it.
Yeah.
And it's a really special mindset and it's a really special mentality. I look forward to you experiencing that in your car.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm super excited about it. So it'll be great.
All right. It'll be a good vacation for you too, I'm sure.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you guys will probably be looking at me in my car and be like, wow, that guy's having a lot of fun. So at least he's driving what he built, right? It's definitely not a trailer queen.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's what it's about.
All right. Take care, man. We'll see you around and thanks for hanging out.
Appreciate it, guys. Take care. Have a good rest of the week.
You too. Bye.
There it is, man. Not too many fourth generation companies left out there.
That's, you know,
I
really
think it's
cool.
really cool that he stepped in and like made his own way with the company doing something unique is really special. I think a lot, like he said, I think a lot of people when they get raised and there's a company there, they don't want anything to do with it. They're just like, nope, I got to go my own way. This is not for me. I got to
forge
my own path. And then, you know, I think it's,
but he was able to do that though in the company,
he was.
Which is
and
very
I think
cool.
I think it's actually probably, I wonder if a lot of people flee that position because of the pressure of having to perform.
Right.
Right. I mean, just imagine the weight of being like, all right, I'm going to come into this company that my great, great grandfather built on the streets of Bombay.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to, that's some pressure right there. How do I not fuck this up? You're walking around with this pile of China plates, basically, to not screw it up. So
not drop them. Yeah.
Yeah. I wonder if that's one of the reasons why people don't kind of embrace that.
No, hey, it's really cool what he has done.
Yeah.
We didn't even get to talk about the projects. Have you gone through their website and just looked at the project cars?
There are so many rad cars that they've built and done. It's
awesome.
It's endless. His 911 is absolutely incredible.
It's amazing.
We'll make a post about some photos of the 911 that he's got so you guys can see it on Instagram. We'll do something. It's really awesome. The fact that he's bringing that out to the rally, that car is, I mean, hundreds of thousands of dollars to build. Like it is an incredible car. I probably would have stuck with some H4 headlights, but that's just me. You know, I mean, the headlights are, there's always a sticky point on it.
Can't win them all.
When are we doing burnouts in the van?
Ooh.
When is this van done?
Well, want to do it with the new tires or the old tires? Probably the old tires.
Will it do a burnout?
No clue.
No clue.
Sure.
It's a V6.
Maybe. Yeah. Mm. I think we can do a burnout.
Hey, can you do one thing? And this is, well, I don't know why I'm having a personal conversation with you on the podcast right now, but the doors that we have, the doors on the side of the van open like sideways barn doors. And it's dope. Like, you lift up and it opens up.
Yeah,
like,
I explained it once, like, there's a gull wing, but then there's also a bottom gull wing, right?
The bottom gull wing needs some support.
It needs a chain. Yes, exactly.
Yes,
I'm way ahead of you. Way ahead of you. Yep, okay. No, way ahead of you on that one.
All right. And I know that Jeff has a secret. Yeah. And I know Jeff has a secret project plan for the van, too. Which
does
I'm
okay.
Really...
I gotta talk to him about that because we got to get him going.
Yeah, we've outed him out now publicly. So now he has to.
Good. Well, now he has to follow through, right?
Now he has to hand.
That's called accountability, Chris.
It is forced accountability. Forced accountability.
Love it.
What do we got going on next week? Do you know? Is it on the calendar? What do we got?
I don't.
You know what
off
we should
the
do
top
is.
Of my head.
I sent you a text message.
Okay.
Last
what did the
night
text message
at like
say?
Midnight. It said
when I would do not disturb.
Yeah, it's Mouse Utopia Experiments.
Oh,
did
yeah.
you look that
I
up?
I had no idea what you were talking about.
Okay. I would love to do it, like a story this. On this. Yeah. So, like, some guy decided to do like a social construct study about mice and what happens if they just have everything that they need.
Right. Yeah.
And the dudes quit having sex with the female mice. The female mice started eating their young, and a bunch of the male mice just started like killing the other mice for no reason.
That's
and I
right.
I
kind
of went, huh. and I watched like an hour long thing about it. Super interesting. Maybe we can do like a driver's club episode of that or something.
Okay.
I don't know if that's
we
for
could totally do that.
Hey, by the way, did you know that we have a driver's club? We have a driver's club, Jake.
What is that? What does that get
Overcrest
us? How do we find out more?
.com/driver's club. Sign up and support the show, support the rally, support us.
Exclusive content like we're talking about right now.
Yep.
Absolutely. I think you should go over there and do it. You get early access to merch. Get all sorts of
amazing
benefits.
We have been in talks with some new
benefits.
Merch. I know I've talked about a secret project. We do have a secret project. It's just, it's low key and I'm not pushing on the secret project, but we're going to have a secret project that I'm going to send
what you're talking about.
Yeah. I'm going to send it to
every driver's club members,
$5, $10, $25. I don't care who you're going to get this secret project.
I love it. Yes.
On that note, we will see you guys next week with whatever the fuck that's going on. I don't know what it is, but
I do have like multiple stories in progress here.
Of what?
Do you want me to tease you?
Do I get to pick one for next week?
Depends which ones are done. Have you ever heard of Stuxnet?
No.
Stuxnet. Have you heard about the Iranian when they were doing enrichment and we sent basically malware to blow up their enrichment
devices?
That's
recent, right? That's somewhat
like
recent.
Like 10 years ago?
Yeah, we blew up their nuclear reactor with a virus or something.
Yeah, basically. Okay. Not quite. But anyway, so I have the full history of that written up.
Okay.
I have the history of air conditioning.
Okay.
In collaboration.
Is it good?
It's in collaboration with our friend Austin.
Okay. All right.
So that could be cool.
Could be down for that.
Right?
Yep.
Because you're also going to be working on a project with that.
Yes.
Oh, and
God. I almost said something that I can't say.
Okay.
No, sorry. I almost let something slip that I can't let slip yet.
Is it something
what
I
else
know
you got?
About? What else we got?
Maybe.
Okay. History of NASCAR is still in the works. It's overwhelming. I don't know where to go with it. But every time I'm on social media, I find some other crazy cool story that happened like along with NASCAR. Just it's such a wild, that whole environment is so cool. So that's also in there too.
You need to put it together like I did the Skunk Works one. You need to just find like maybe you could just find like a decade to talk about and bring someone in from that period of time and we could do like 6 or 7 episodes about it and we could talk because you have to follow some
it
sort of stream with
up.
The story.
I know.
Yeah.
What I'm working on right now is basically before the formation of NASCAR itself, like what led up to it. And so
that's
because
a very
they always.
Time.
Yeah. And you always hear about like how it was stemmed out of these bootleggers, right? And racing their cars to get away from the police and during Prohibition. So it's a very interesting time. So we
can
have
you get
all
one
sorts
of these old-timers
cool
on?
Content coming out.
You got to find one of these old-timers.
I'm pretty sure they're all dead, Chris.
So we're talking about 20s, 30s? Someone's got to be 100. Come on, find somebody. Find somebody that was, like, maybe they were 4 years old. My grandpa is 90. Ooh, these dudes are all dead, aren't they?
Yeah, they're all dead, Chris. Sorry to say.
Man.
Once we get into, like, the 60s, then we can talk to people.
Okay. Okay, well, come on. Hey, my grandpa could talk about stuff. He was born in 32.
Okay, I mean,
so
that's
maybe the 40s? When did NASCAR
40s.
Start?
40s.
Like, when did it
the
officially
official
start?
Formation was, the 40s, because it was post-war.
So maybe there's a kid who drove around with his dad when he was like 5 or 6 years old that can tell us what it was like. That fictional person. Find that person.
Okay. We'll do that.
On that note, we will see you guys next week.
Take care.